For some students at New Mexico State University, attending class means visiting a sun-soaked island surrounded by deep waters as their professor sits next to them in the sand. The students have class in this space called Second Life once a week, or at least their avatars do. Now, avatars, as you may know, are digital versions of people. They can walk, talk, run, even fly. Before we introduce their professor, Michael Demers of New Mexico State, I want to tell you that my avatar, which kind of looks like Anderson Cooper in a wetsuit, is running over this island on our website, npr.org. Now, Michael Demers, professor of geography, joins us from his campus. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you hold classes in what's called Second Life. For those of us who aren't familiar, and I wasn't until I began to read the introduction, what is Second Life? And, you know, isn't First Life hard enough?
Well, sometimes it is. The whole idea is that Second Life is a virtual world, and it started out more as a game than anything, but it has evolved over the years. It's approximately 5 years old now. And what has happened over the years is that people like me have noticed that the students coming into the universities are gamers, and they're familiar with living inside the computer. And so my idea was, if they're in the computer, that's where I need to be as well.
So you've created what amounts to a virtual world on this small island.
Well, I didn't set up the whole island, just so you know.
Yeah.
I set up this classroom space that you see behind you.
Mm-hmm.
The island is owned by
New
Mexico
State. When you say you see behind me, let me explain to our radio audience our first and last responsibility here, that I guess we're probably both looking at screens. And
yes,
looking at an island with sand and mountains and water behind it. And there's a sign in the distance that welcomes me to New Mexico State, or welcomes my avatar. Who's the handsome buck standing in front of me?
That's me. That's Gadget Loon. That's my alter ego.
Your alter ego. So you don't really look like this. This guy looks like Fabio used to look.
Well, I am 6'10" in Second Life.
All right, and you're standing on like a disco dance floor.
Yes, in fact, one of my students is sitting on the dance ball behind you, behind your avatar.
Behind my avatar. I think I can rotate my avatar to take a look, right, if I'm not mistaken? Oh, yes, that's one of your students, right?
That is one of my students, yes.
Excuse me. You must be Anna Patterson, right?
Yes, sir.
Do you need to go to class this way to learn something, as the professor indicated? Is this more fun? Do you learn more?
I find that especially for visual labs, it's actually very helpful, since I'm a more tactile learner than a visual or audio learner. And because it's actually in-game and you can build in here, you can actually do more interaction with what you would than you would necessarily just sitting in a lab looking at different map projections as opposed to creating the different map projections.
Because this Second Life island, this has desert, this has mountains, this has all kinds of topography and geography that you can see, I guess. What's the logic of all these topographical features in the island? And you know, by the way, I mean, when you get to certain areas, you know, you can hear the wind blowing, you can hear the whoosh of the waves, that sort
yes.
of thing.
Yes. It's designed to make you feel like you're in a real environment.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I have that campfire setting over by my slide presenter, and I use that for when I want to sit down and talk about projects and stuff like that.
My avatar is walking towards the campfire.
So you can come over here.
Okay.
And you can sit down and chat, and you can hear the fire crackling, and it literally puts the student at ease.
That's a fire crackling, all right. I'm gonna sit down. I think I'm gonna sit down. Okay,
yep,
there we are, sitting next to each other on a log. So what do we learn by sitting here, you and me, in front of the crack-laden campfire?
Well, it depends on who your audience is and what you're trying to teach.
Yeah.
We have, for example, there are some people who are teaching ballet inside Second Life, and they're literally going through the various motions using their avatars.
Yeah, but teaching your damn avatar how to dance ballet isn't going to get you a job at the Joffrey.
That may be true, but it does teach you all of the various movements, because you have to know the movements in gory detail in order to get them get an avatar to do what the human body does.
All right. Well,
it's actually much harder to do.
Well, okay, my point is, in the end, have you learned something that's really useful when you've learned something in Second Life?
Oh, I hope so.
Absolutely. One of the things we're finding is that, and you've actually suggested this, we have people who do not know how to interact with each other.
Yeah.
And yet, inside Second Life, they are, in fact, interacting with each other. We're finding, for example, some classes, the students come in fact, my students come in here without my even asking them. They're here, and they're getting together, and they're learning things. They're exchanging information.
They are creating what we call a learning community, and that's really important.
Professor, it's been very good talking to you. I'm very grateful for all of your time, and I'm very grateful for your avatar's time, too.
Thank you.
And if you could thank Anna Patterson and her avatar, too.
I will do that.
Michael Demers is a geography professor at New Mexico State University. You can see a video of Professor Demers' avatar trying to get my avatar a cup of coffee. You can see a picture of Leanne Hansen's avatar, you know, kind of sultry. And you can learn how to make your own avatar, all on our blog, npr.org/soapbox.
Tonight, we get the last word from the L Word. Showtime bids its groundbreaking series goodbye after 6 years of lesbian drama. At friends' houses and in gay bars across the country, women are getting together to mark its passage. Here's Angela Lombardi, the manager of Phase One, a Washington, D.C. lesbian bar.
This is kind of the first show that was only for us. I would say very few things ever are dedicated to just this community, and this was one of those things that if you love it or you hate it, you're still kind of inclined to watch it because you want to see how we're being portrayed.
I don't know what I was thinking. There's no reason on earth that I wouldn't want to make a baby with you using a donor who's black. I think I was
don't
really
scared because I would love to make a baby with you.
You just don't see scenes like that anywhere else on TV. Laurel Holloman and series creator Eileen Chaykin came into our studios at NPR West the other day, and I asked how they were feeling about the show's end. Laurel Holloman answered this way.
I was being pretty tough. Well, it's okay. It's fine. It's fine. And now it's actually really sad.
You know, for a lot of women, a lot of lesbian women, this has been much more than just a television show. It's been a 6-year social engagement. We stopped in at Phase One here in Washington, where Angela Lombardi used to tape the L Word on her VCR at home.
Then run the VHS tape over here. And then we'd show it then, and we would call it the L Word Remix because we'd play last week's episode and then immediately following the new episode, but it would be like delayed time because we're bootleg, and so it involves some very fast driving.
Eileen Chaykin, why do you think that is? Why would people rather watch the show at a bar than just order Showtime and watch it at home?
I think it was such a phenomenon for gay women to have our own show in the mainstream popular culture, and it became a communal event. It had that kind of Rocky Horror Picture Show-esque kind of participatory quality.
Walk me back 6 years. Tell me about why you created this and a little bit about yourself.
When I was an executive, I did some television, some series television, but I wasn't thinking that I wanted to make a television show. I just had an idea. I had a notion that the stories of my friends and my community weren't being told, and they were good stories and interesting and indeed juicy, and that I wanted to tell them.
And your community, meaning you're a gay woman yourself, and you wanted that on screen.
That is what I meant.
Kristen Beers works the door at Phase One, and this is what she had to say about the show.
I mean, like, I like rock and roll, and, like, you know, I'm, like, kind of dirty, and, like, I like being, like, a normal kid. And these lesbians are, like, you know, like, high-powered, like, movie producers and shit like that. Like, give me a break. Come on. Like, do I know lesbians like that? Even in L.A.? No. I'm sure that they exist, but I don't identify with that.
Eileen Chaykin, what do you think?
There are all kinds of lesbians in the world, and we chose to make a television show about a particular group of affluent lesbians. I wanted to make a television show that operated on the same set of principles as many other serialized mainstream dramas, and I wanted my characters to be every bit as attractive, sexy, glamorized, and fabulous as the people, the heterosexual characters that you see on other nighttime soaps.
How have these women's relationships changed and mutated over the years?
So vastly. And Laura, what do you think about how your character has changed over the years?
I thought it was a wonderful, wild ride and a gift for any actress. I mean, it's amazing. My character went through so much from being in a kind of a wife-like type of position to being abandoned, to being cheated on, to having a baby by herself. She went back to a guy. She came back into the fold. I think when you hear a story about a couple that's been in the closet and been together, and they've been in the closet for 25 years, and they're talking to you, and they're crying, and there's tears coming down, and you realize that there's not going to be another job where you have this profound emotional effect on somebody. And that gratitude is kind of mind-blowing.
Eileen, do you feel that you've left a lesbian audience wanting to see a series like this, and now that you go, a sort of responsibility that somebody create one?
Yes, I do think that there's an unmet responsibility out there. I think that we, sadly, are leaving the television landscape no better represented than we were when The L Word began. I'm not sure why that is. I think that the culture has changed vastly and progressively, and the entertainment culture is lagging behind.
Eileen Shaikin, creator of the Showtime series The L Word, and Laurel Holloman, one of the original cast members. The series ends tonight. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie.
This is the way.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Walt White is a sick, desperate man. He's a former high school chemistry teacher in Albuquerque who has terminal lung cancer. His chemotherapy is expensive, and his family needs the money to keep going after he dies. So, Walt and a former student have hatched an unorthodox business plan.
$737,000, that's what I need. That is what I need. You and I both clear about 70 grand a week. That's only 10 and a half more weeks. Call it 11. 11 more drug deals, and always in a public place from now on. It's doable. Definitely doable.
That's Bryan Cranston in the role of Walt White on the critically adored show Breaking Bad. It's on the AMC Network, and last year Mr. Cranston's performance won him an Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Drama Series. Season 2 begins tomorrow on Sunday, and we are joined now by Bryan Cranston from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Scott, thanks for having me.
We need to be pretty plain about this if people didn't get it. They're dealing crystal meth, aren't they?
Yes, it is, and it's a horrible, disastrous drug that is a scourge to society. By using crystal meth as the centerpiece drug for the show, it does raise the stakes. It does raise our responsibility as well as storytellers.
Help us set the storyline for season 2 when it opens.
Well, in season 1, Breaking Bad just starts to uncover the decision that Walter White has made to become this drug dealer to make as much money as he can for his family. In season 2, we see the results of this terrible decision. And it's really about a good man who makes bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's very relatable to the viewing audience, is that they see themselves or someone they know in Walter White, and they can actually embrace him for that. In season 2, everything that he has worked for, to keeping the family unit together, becomes jeopardized. My wife, Skylar, played by Anna Gunn, terrific actress, she begins to realize that I've been lying about certain things and forces me to own up to these things. And I don't know exactly how much she knows, so I don't reveal everything.
Walt, did you spend the entire night out here?
Not all of it. I did have a touch of my stomach, you know, and I knew I was going to be up and down, so I just didn't want to wake you.
Mm-hmm. My brother-in-law, who's a DEA agent, is hot on the trail of this new drug kingpin in the area, and legally the noose is tightening around my neck as well.
Do I have this right? You were a police science major in college? You actually have a degree in police science?
I do. I do. And I thought it was a very macho thing to do when I was young.
I confess my grandfather was a Chicago cop. And he very definitely believed that a really great policeman was a fine actor.
I think there's a lot to that. In order to coerce some information out of people, I think you do have to know how to manipulate and to encourage and take on a persona of perhaps a friend when you're not, when you're, you know, from a different capacity.
Well, this raises the question about your character, Walter White. Is he, in a sense, released by his illness to try something that in some part of himself has always fascinated him? By that, I mean a criminal enterprise?
I think this comes out of left field for him. He's a man of science, mm-hmm. where everything makes sense, where there's a mathematical answer to every question. And he steps out of his classroom into this world that he very hastily chose, and he realizes it's in complete chaos. He can't control it. He's got a tiger by the tail, and he's dealing with these unsavory, horrible murderers and thugs and drug users, and they're unreliable and untrustworthy, and it's the anxiety level in him is rising to uncontrollable levels. I think the irony that my character found is that after 25 years of living with regret of missed opportunities and basically imploding from that, from the weight of that, and becoming invisible to himself and to society, this apparent death sentence of terminal lung cancer has opened up new opportunities for him for life.
As the series has progressed, we learn that Walt is not exactly working with Frank Nitti in drug trafficking. Jesse, his partner, he feels that they got to be armed. Let's play that.
Okay. He's got 5 bullets. I finally figured out how to look. I figured it out. I say we get a second gun, right? For you. I mean, don't we like double our chances? I mean, mathematically?
I've got a better idea.
Thank God.
Yeah, he really is a mess. You know, he's a high school dropout and he's a drug dealer.
Let's stipulate that Breaking Bad contains some of the elements for which cable television has become most famous and celebrated, nudity and profanity. But tastefully done in each case.
You know, we do have some leeway on cable to be able to more accurately tell this story, and there's some language and some nudity. I'd like to apologize to the listeners right now because they'll see me and my altogether in episode 3. Where I have to back up a particular lie, and in order to have people believe that I have temporary amnesia, mm-hmm. I strip down completely naked and wander through a grocery store.
So that wasn't a body double, huh?
No, that was my pasty little butt.
Well, you kept the language nice and manageable for us. Thanks very much.
I try.
And not to make excuses for anybody's criminal behavior, but the economy has changed substantially since Breaking Bad went into production.
It really has. It's just coincidence that our show deals with a family that is going from paycheck to paycheck and is struggling to make ends meet, has to have a second job, is about to go in and test just how much insurance, medical insurance, does he have. Realizing that it can't handle a catastrophic illness like lung cancer. And so there's a lot of areas in which the viewers can relate to this struggling family. And it poses the question, I mean, if you had a year and a half to live, what would you do? What would you do for your family? Yeah. Now, hopefully you wouldn't make the same decisions that Walter White makes, but it might be somewhere as desperate.
Mr. Cranston, thanks so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Scott.
Bryan Cranston, who stars in Breaking Bad, the drama series on AMC, premieres its second season tomorrow, Sunday night.